My name's Victoria Matei.
My name's Olga Araceli.
And we are both undocumented women of color.
Intro music, intro music. Ba-boom, bum, bum, ba-ba-ba-bum, bum, bum, bow.
So we started this podcast because we want to talk about what it's like to be undocumented during this time. We want to bring on different people. We want to challenge different narratives and have conversations about what it's like to be undocumented. We also want to talk more about the dehumanization, exploitation, and disposal of immigrants, not just in the United States, but throughout the world.
We want to open up the space for other undocumented folks to join the conversation. We want to make sure that we can build healing without borders. We want to continue the conversation about intersectionalities between our communities. And remember, we hold the power and strength to liberate ourselves.
So before we got started, we wanted to share a little bit about ourselves and share our stories. We know that you're going to be listening and we want other people to learn about us as we go through this. There's going to be a lot of learning and reflecting as we move through this podcast. And so we wanted to share a little bit about ourselves.
Yeah, definitely. Also, make sure that you feel, you know, that connection with us, that we're not just a voice behind this mic, but we're actually someone like you.
Okay, so Olga, tell me a little bit about how you got here.
So I was 5 years old and I crossed over kind of on my own.
You crossed over on your own?
Yes. So by that, I mean without like any family members, without my parents or my sister at the time. So when I came over, I was kind of handed over to my grandma, you know, and she moved over here to the U.S. Mm-hmm. when I was probably 2 or 3 years old. So I vaguely remembered her.
So you don't remember anything at all?
I don't. I was asleep for most of this trip. And when I kind of woke up, I was in California and with this person who I call grandma. And so I was handed over. And she just kind of, you know, put me back to bed with my aunts. And the story kind of just started from there.
Who handed you over?
I don't know. Again, I was asleep. So I vaguely remember like any details. I do remember just kind of like being asleep in a van and then just waking up in Cali. And my grandma and my aunts, that's all I remember. But before I continue, Vicky, how did you get here?
So I kind of feel like I had a luckier or I guess more privileged route in coming to the United States. My father had a visa to work in the United States, so he had been gone for some time. And my mother and I and my 6-month-old sister were just visiting. We were not planning on staying. We left everything behind. Mm-hmm. We packed just a suitcase each and came to visit my dad. Once our visas expired, we just decided to stay. And ever since then, we've been here since 1995.
Wow, 1995. Okay. As a child, did you ever think or question, when are we going to go back?
I think the only memory I really have of coming to the United States was being on a plane. I remember sitting on a plane next to my mom, and my mom was holding my sister, and I remember just feeling scared and uncertain about what was happening. It was my first time ever traveling, so I think I was just kind of stuck in that moment. And I just have this like small little like flashback of that and only that. I ended up coming to Redmond, Washington, and lived in a 2-bedroom apartment with several of my cousins and aunts and uncles.
I feel like that is a experience a lot of us share, you know, definitely coming and sharing a household or a space with multiple family members. How do you think that changed for you, or how was that different from the life back at home or back in Mexico?
So what's interesting is that in Mexico, for the majority of my life in Mexico, I was an only child. So I was given everything that I ever needed. I had all the love and support that my parents could give me. And coming here, I think it was different. I didn't have family that was my age. I didn't have cousins. I very much so, you know, I was so young. I don't really remember a lot of it. I think one of my like first memories of being in the United States is when I turned 4 years old and seeing my family come together and celebrate that, you know, we had made it to the United States.
How was life after, now that you had family and that you had built that bond?
It's hard to say because I can't really compare it to anything since I don't remember too much of Mexico. I do know that the majority of my family is in Mexico, but the chances are that I don't know if I'll ever get to meet them again. I'm sure it's the same as for you, that a lot of your family was left behind and you just have more so your immediate family here. Can you tell me a little bit about what like your first, what was it like when you learned that you were undocumented? Like, how old were you? What were the thoughts that were going through your head? You know, how did that change your life from that moment on?
I can't really recall the moment that, you know, I learned that I was undocumented. I think as time passed and as I got older, this being undocumented or this title kind of just like made sense. It was like, this is something normal. This is,
you know, just how
our, like, or this is just how, like, my community lives, you know. You would get a fake social, or you would do this, or you would do that, you know, and you just kind of work and build your life. It wasn't too much, I think, of a struggle that I saw because it was, it was
pretty common.
Yeah, it was pretty common, and so that was just kind of like the norm. So growing up, thinking back to high school and just, you know, like, okay, applying to colleges or doing this or doing that. Friends kind of didn't really talk about it. Like I mentioned before, yeah, you know,
it was a secret.
It was a secret. Yeah. You kind of just kept it in. You didn't tell people or put it out there, you know, in the open. So most of the friends that I hanged out with were Latinx. So we all kind of had that general idea of like, okay, some of us are undocumented, some of us aren't. We definitely have like mixed status, you know, families.
So my experience was totally different. My experience was, I was, you know, going to middle school and junior high with mostly white folks. I didn't have a lot of Latinx community in Kirkland, Washington. So for me, I was always open about being undocumented. I remember being in seventh grade writing papers about illegal immigration and using this language that was very much so ingrained and into who I was, even though it was very dehumanizing at the time. I didn't understand that. So for me, being undocumented was something that I realized at a young age and started talking about at a young age.
Yeah, and that's very interesting how some of us, you know, can come to that conclusion and realize, this isn't right. You know, there's something wrong. Why do I have to keep it a secret? Why am I treated less than others?
So Olga, we should talk a little bit about the organizing that we've been doing for the last year and a half. I think a lot of that started with Blue Group and kind of mobilizing students on campus. So what are some of your memories about that?
We wanted to make sure, you know, our Blue Group students, or like undocumented students in general. Not all undocumented students on campus are involved with Blue Group. So what we wanted to make sure was that they were still supported, you know, and felt that at any time, if they needed us, that they knew where to find us. So we wanted to make sure that the university also
saw the importance of us being there. Yeah. So what we started doing was creating resources for undocumented folks, whether that was through fundraising, whether that was scholarships, whether that was conference opportunities for professional development. We started organizing undocumented folks on campus to demand things that they deserved, such as like an undocumented student center, which is, you know, something that's ongoing and that we're still working on.
Yeah. More help, you know, financially wise. I think we also saw a need for, you know, our like mental health. A lot of the things that we hold in, just because being undocumented is such a, you know, like a taboo or talking about it, we hold that inside. Mm-hmm. And so that affects us, you know, affects our mental health. So we saw a need for that too.
Yeah, not a lot of people understand what it's like to live with anxiety, mm-hmm, at literally 24/7.
Yeah, so definitely connected also, you know, or try to connect with resources and how we can, you know, also get other clubs, other identities kind of involved, you know. Being undocumented isn't just a Latinx thing. And so I think we also wanted to make sure that
that we were creating an inclusive space for, mm-hmm, other intersectional identities along with being undocumented.
Mm-hmm.
So we did a lot of organizing within the city as well. We were able to work with a grassroots organization called Community to Community that helped us start keep Bellingham Families working. So it was a campaign, mm-hmm, that strived to not only create visibility about the undocumented community, but also mobilize the community and City Hall and the County Council to do something to protect their community, since we are so close to the border. Can you tell me a little bit of some of the events that we held, some of the conversations we had, the people we met?
Mm-hmm. We've met, I think, two of the best organizers, I think,
In the world.
Yeah. Like they're amazing. Rosalinda Guillen and Maru Mora. A huge shout out to them. They taught us a lot, you know, of what we know, and really also gave us that space to grow and
The space and the tools.
The space and the tools, definitely. I think when we went into this, we didn't really think about what we were getting
into at all. Yeah.
Into. Yeah. But they led us and they made sure that we had a voice in this say, you know, that
we were represented, mm-hmm, in the community as, mm-hmm, a whole.
Yeah. Because even as we are young, you know, a lot of us could be not really taken seriously. And I think one of the things that will always stick with me, that kind of Maru was saying, that yes, we look, you know, naive and like this, but don't underestimate us, because we were definitely powerful. And I think in their roles, they gave us the confidence to keep moving and pushing, mm-hmm, and fighting back.
Mm-hmm. They really empowered us to start, you know, thinking about what our lives meant in the scheme of all of this and what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we also were able to reach out to a larger audience and show the community and the, like, all of Bellingham what, you know, we needed.
Mm-hmm.
And through many city council meetings, many meetings with the mayor, with the sheriff, working with many lawyers to get this ordinance passed that was done by the community. You know, we worked so many hours, and at the end of the day, what happened? What happened? Like,
at the end of the day, unfortunately, the ordinance that our community wrote didn't pass. It
was completely taken apart and, mm-hmm, made into something that wasn't, you know, for the community, but rather for city council to, mm-hmm, give themselves a pat on the back.
Yes. And, you know, kind of just like also protect their.
There, yeah. So one of the goals for the ordinance was to create a civilian oversight board, a board that, you know, that was that was made up of community members that people could go to and report things that were happening in the community, such as if police were to racially profile someone, mm-hmm, or if someone were to experience, you know, ICE or Border Patrol following them from a courthouse meeting or whatever that was. Like, you know, there was this need for an oversight board, not to police the police, and that's kind of how a lot of people took it,
mm-hmm,
but rather to make sure that the marginalized communities were having a say and a voice and kind of, you know, given a little bit of control,
mm-hmm,
of what was happening, yeah, overall.
Yeah, that there was accountability, right?
Accountability, exactly.
Because I think now that as we've seen, you know, time progress, a lot of the police enforcement doesn't have or hold that accountability. We've noticed this, you know, with like Black Lives Matter, where a lot of these cops aren't being held accountable mm-hmm. for the death of these brown and black folks. And we saw the need for that community oversight board, where our community members felt comfortable going to speak with somebody about an issue that they mm-hmm. saw was important or that was affecting them, without having that fear of, you know, police brutality, or are they going to call ICE? Am I, you know, going to be profiled?
And Bellingham has many cases of profiling undocumented folks. They have many cases of calling Border Patrol or ICE to translate for police. So mm-hmm. in this community, it's something that happens all the time. So, you know, along with some of the mobilizing we did with Blue Group and with the city council and the community, we also kind of started at the detention center here in Tacoma. And this is one of the largest detention centers in the Pacific Northwest, housing over 1,500 beds that essentially dispose of our community members and super quickly. And they do mm-hmm. it kind of like in this weird, like warehouse space. You wouldn't even know that there's a detention center back there.
Yeah. So I'm from Tacoma, and like you said, you wouldn't even know. I had lived there for quite a couple of years now, 10 plus, and I never imagined there was such a place down there. The area where it's at is very industrial, very, you know, you see a lot of truck drivers, just it's also by a port, and so it's very well hidden, and so you don't think about it as you drive through the port and see, you know, lovely water and all these ships. You don't imagine, or you can't see the people that are being held in these cages.
Yeah, and I think one of the biggest things that shocked me about going to the detention center was how many black and brown bodies are hired to dehumanize essentially their own communities. I think that was one of the most interesting things that I saw, was that the people that work in detention are mostly black and brown people.
Mm. That's very unfortunate. But also, it's something that we've seen, you know, we've seen it a lot now. I think our own kind of like self-hatred, or that trying to assimilate and be part of the greater, you know, community, kind of really brainwashes us into believing that our own people are criminals, you know. And I don't know if you've seen it, but I definitely in the experiences that I've lived through, I've seen how, you know, like even white Latinx can really
be against us, be against immigrants in general. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And you see a lot of them supporting Trump as well, which is like mind boggling.
Very, very.
So along with some of the work we've done on campus, at city council, at the detention center, we started presenting, and all over the state and out of state too, we started training other people to present on how to work with undocumented folks, or what it was like, you know, to be an undocumented student in higher education. We also started organizing undocumented folks and teaching them what it was like to create a group that could support them with different resources. Mm-hmm. So what was that experience like? It's kind of like, you know, it's kind of repetitive, and it kind of seems like you're always giving a lot of yourself, especially because mm-hmm. of a lot of our labor is completely free. Mm-hmm. After many years of us both speaking, like we're very much so recently barely making very much money, getting paid very little for our speaking. But, you know, we don't do it for the money. We more so do it because we know what we have to do for our community. And something someone said to me that really stuck with me was that if you are educating folks in an institution, you deserve to get paid. But if you're organizing for your community with your community, now that's a different story. And, you know, I think since we do live in a capitalistic society, we need to make ends meet. And a lot mm-hmm. of this organizing work does take a lot of time.
A lot of time, a lot of work.
A lot of emotional labor.
Yes, especially emotional labor.
And having to deal with people that don't understand and can't even wrap their heads around what it's like.
Yes.
I think that's the most frustrating part, is that some people can't even stop and listen to what we have to say or share.
Also, you know, them wanting to hear our story. They always want us to share and us to pour ourselves out and us to, you know, try to give them that glimpse or into what it's like. Again, like you said, the emotional labor, you know, that puts us through. A lot of us have ended up tears, sobbing, just really
being tokenized.
Tokenized, yes. Oh, how they love that. Tequila shot. Oh, that should be a thing. Shot break.
Since Olga's shy, she needs to take a shot.
Yeah, when things are getting intense, this is what we're gonna do. We're gonna take a shot.
So I kind of want to talk about what's next. Like, what can people expect next from this podcast and from us?
What's next? What's next? We'd like to invite other people and other members to come in and kind of share, you know, a little bit about their experience. We'd like to make this a very open and intersectional kind of space, you know, where we not just talk about the undocumented experience, but our communities of color experience in general.
Yeah, and like the intersectional identities within our community. Mm-hmm. I want to do a takeover. I want to docu Black folks to take over. I want to docu queer folks to take over.
Yes.
I want to provide that space for everyone. Mm-hmm. I think something else that's to come is, you know, not just having the typical conversations you hear about undocumented folks. Like, let's start talking about what immigration is like in other countries. Let's start talking about what a world would look like without detention centers. Yeah. Or let's talk about the exploitation that immigrants in general have faced since the United States was here.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, challenging conversations, having critical thoughts, and bringing on people that want to have those discussions and that challenge our own ideas and discussions. Yes. And I think that is the value in the diversity of tactics within our movement, is that even though they're so different, they play such a crucial role in moving forward. So I think that's what people can expect from us, is challenging people and wanting to bring people on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Keeping that conversation going and ensuring, you know, that we have the space to continue talking about it and make sure we have that space to continue this conversation, because this is not going to be something that's gonna, you know, necessarily end with a Clean Dream Act or, you know, some kind of passage or legislation. This needs to be something that is constantly, you know, talked about. This land is indigenous land, and so I think remembering and going back to how even recognizing, you know, that this is indigenous land and the justice that needs to be done to
to liberate our communities and ourselves, and what, and like, you know, having that conversation of what does our liberation look like, and does that look like an age of healing, does that look like education and art, is it encompass all of that? You know, and I want to ask that question to anyone that comes on and, you know, continues this conversation with us.
Yes.
So I think that about wraps up episode 0, and thank you for joining us.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at ashotoftruthpodcast@gmail.com. You can also send us a nice tweet at @shotoftruthpodcast or look on Instagram for behind the scene photos at @shotoftruthpodcast. You can also find us on Patreon and donate to our podcast at Shot of Truth Podcast. You can just assume it's all Shot of Truth Podcast. Podcast, podcast, podcast. A Shot of Truth Podcast, a Shot of Truth Podcast, a Shot of Truth Podcast.
Be-doo-boo, outro music, this is a sound of the outro music.
This has been a Pseudoscience production.